Information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember time you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the 104th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster, coming to you from downtown Portland, Oregon, praradio.org. News, politics, conspiracies, cover-ups, MediaMonarchy.com is your source. We've got apocalyptic clips, bank bombs, the Obamasiah, the Econo crash, civil unrest, and Police State International. They're all parts of the same story of psychic warfare, my friends. It's December 19th, it's episode 104, and it's MediaMonarchy.com.
My dear apocalyptic friend, convince the world will shortly end. I only wanna hold you in my arms. And whisper softly that it's alright if God decides to kill the light and back to start. We return again. I understand your car will likely be unmanned, but what about those sitting in the back, strapped into the baby seat, sweet milk sticking to their feet? Is this the joy felt waking up your heart? Is this the joy felt waking up your dear apocalyptic friend. my arms. And whisper softly that it's our own. God decides to kill the light and pass to stardom. We return.
The ex-lead singer of a band called Clem Snide. He has the strange name of Eef Barzilay. And that song's called Apocalyptic Friend. And I am, and you're mine. Welcome to episode 104 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you from the cold and snow-spitting downtown Portland, Oregon, from the studios of the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, live every Friday morning at 10 Pacific time. And there's good news, and there's bad news. On the fronts of networks that are gracious enough to carry MediaMonarchy.com, the good news, soon, MediaMonarchy.com will be brought to you live on RevereRadioNetwork.com. Live from RevereRadioNetwork.com. So, big thanks to James and Rob and all the fine folks at Revere for sticking with me in Media Monarchy. They've now also picked up the B-sides of Media Monarchy, and I hope you have picked those up as well. Again, there's too much news, too much going on to cram into just 2 little hours each week. 93.9 KBFR in Boulder, Colorado. Boulder Free Radio. Thank you for replaying Media Monarchy. The bad news is that our friends at Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta have taken their Ground Zero underground. I got a message, and all it basically says that Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta has been FCC'd. So they're laying low, and hopefully they will return and let us know. You can, of course, make contact with me at FaceSpace and YouTube and Yahoo, and I am all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And, of course, the podcast, anytime, all the time, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to this apocalyptic episode of Media Monarchy. So it's Friday morning at 10 a.m., December 19th, 2008, as I glance at the breaking news right now. Of course, the auto industry, they're grateful for what they've got. New York Times, with several inches of fresh snow on the ground and with President Bush approving a $17.4 billion auto industry bailout, it was beginning to look a lot more like Christmas in Michigan this morning. There's AP videos, Bush bails out automakers, and again, it's your money going to bail out businesses that should fail. Of course, Mark Deep Throat Felt has died at 95, we just went over that, on the B-side of episode 103. And of course, there's also, you know, big announcements expected in the Kaylee case. And we've got the big West Virginia-Miami game. But fuck that, we've got more important news. And we're going to kick it off close to home. Perhaps you've heard about this story. Two Oregon cops killed after bringing the bomb inside the bank. Two confirmed dead in Oregon bank bombing. So let's get the international perspective right off the bat. This is from the Times of India. That gives you any idea how large this story was. Two police officers were killed and two people were injured after a bomb exploded at a bank in the western U.S. state of Oregon, authorities have confirmed. The fatalities included a bomb disposal expert and a police chief who died after a suspicious package exploded at a branch of the West Coast Bank in Woodburn, 30 miles south of Portland, last Friday. The bomb also seriously injured a 46-year-old police chief and a female bank employee, Oregon State Police said in a statement. No individual or group has claimed responsibility for the bombing, and authorities have issued a $35,000 reward for information leading to the capture of those responsible. And we'll get to that in just a moment. However, let's jump to CNN, as we'll start to pull out the interesting part about this story that, fortunately, from good friends to parents who I know don't pay as much attention to the ins and outs of the news as I do, but they all caught the ridiculous part of this story, and we'll get to it in just a second. This from CNN. The 524 explosion at West Coast Bank came after the nearby Wells Fargo Bank had received a threatening telephone call Friday morning from an unknown person, Oregon State Police said. When authorities arrived at the Wells Fargo Bank, they discovered a, quote, suspicious object that was later determined not to be dangerous. Their investigation led to a suspicious device outside West Coast Bank, and all but two employees were evacuated from the bank. It was not immediately clear why those two employees were not evacuated. The device was brought inside, and it exploded. Chief Hastings said it wasn't clear why it had been brought inside. West Coast Bank President Bob Snewaj, or S-Z-N-E-W-A-J-S, West Coast Bank Prez said that his employees told him authorities, quote, scanned it outside, then brought it in. Now, my man at Cryptagon.com breaks it down bluntly with this. Where else but America would the cops be so stupid that they bring a suspected bomb inside the premises of the intended target? This is Darwin Award Hall of Fame material right here. It'll also be an excuse for cops to shake down lots of clueless hippies who had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Authorities in Oregon are searching for whomever's responsible for a deadly blast at this Oregon West Coast bank that killed two people last week.
That person is very dangerous. And that person needs to be found as soon as possible.
A bank employee found the bomb in bushes outside the bank Friday evening. Police arrived and, for some unknown reason, took it inside when it went off.
They said that there's a huge explosion over at the bank over there, and there was smoke pouring out, and cops were starting to show up, so figured it was probably a bomb.
The blast followed a bomb threat call to a nearby bank. A suspicious object was found there that turned out to be harmless, but investigators say their probe into that incident led them next door to West Coast Bank. Oregon State Trooper William Heikem died in the explosion, along with Police Captain Tom Tennant.
A family man, a dedicated to his family, his children.
The federal government is offering a $35,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case. Sophia Manos, The Associated Press.
Employee of the bank, the West Coast Bank, and the officers were in the area dealing with the Wells Fargo situation, and so they went over to check that report. The first one was determined not to be dangerous, and so the second one is the one which did detonate. Yes, that was the one that resulted, the explosion resulted in the death of the two officers and critical injury to the chief.
Yeah, the device was outside. It was taken in the bank, but the bank had already been evacuated prior to them even going inside the bank with the object. There were two employees still in the bank. One of those was an employee that suffered minor injuries.
At this point, no indication of any further devices, but any things that the state police and the other agencies working on it, just precautionary, that we always treat this as precautionary if there's any other devices out there.
Oregon bank blast kills police officer bomb expert. Now, I want you to understand something, right? A false flag operation is where the government stages some kind of attack and then blames it on a particular enemy that they want to go after. Okay, and the reason why I'm bringing this article up is because they had a bomb explosion inside a bank in Woodburn, Oregon. And state bomb disposal technician was killed. And they say they don't have any suspects, but that the person is dangerous and needs to be found as soon as possible. Which means they're going everywhere, kicking down doors, looking for this guy. But I want you to go down 4 paragraphs down, and you will see where it says that they took the bomb inside the bank. That they found the bomb outside the bank. Here it is. The police found it outside the bank. And the bomb exploded after officers took it inside. They found it in the back in some bushes. And they took it inside and blew the bank up and injured a bunch of people. And now they are offering a $35,000 reward. And they're all over the place kicking in doors looking for this guy. Which is them. They even admit it. I don't know how long this article will be allowed to stay up, but they took the bomb in.
Jumping to the conclusions of this being some sort of false flag, black op inside job, I will be the first to call bullshit on something that I think stinks. As it stands right now, I don't believe this story stinks of any kind of false flag, black op, inside job. Amazingly, yes, it's going to come out of my mouth. I think this looks to be a case of good old-fashioned small-town incompetence. Yes, it pains me to say that, but let's look at some of the updates. 3 from the Oregonian, which I'm sure have a boner to get another Pulitzer for breaking news coverage. First, arrest made in Woodburn bank bombing. Authorities arrested a suspect in the Salem area in the Woodburn bank bombing that killed two police chiefs, that killed two police explosive experts and injured the town's police chief and a bank employee. Again, at the time of this writing, the name of the suspect, address of the arrest, or any details about the investigation were not released to protect the integrity of the investigation and the safety of the officers continuing to investigate this crime. That's a press release from Marion County Sheriff's Office with links for you. Update number 2. Woodburn bombing a father-son job. The bomb that ripped through a West Coast bank branch in Woodburn last Friday and killed two police officers was the product of a plot that dates to at least November involving a father and son team, according to information released by authorities Tuesday. Investigators say the son, Joshua Abraham Turnage, T-U-R-N-I-D-G-E, 32 years old of Salem, Oregon, secured disposable cell phones, prepaid phone cards, and other materials for building the bomb and a decoy. They allege he was involved in making and placing the bomb that exploded as officers dismantled what they mistook to be a hoax. Authorities also contend his 57-year-old father, Bruce Turnage, is connected to the crime, although the alleged extent of his role has not been disclosed. Update number 3 from the Oregonian. Victim made an error. National experts say they were surprised to learn that an Oregon State Police bomb squad technician was confident the green metal box found outside a Woodburn West Coast Bank branch was a hoax device based solely on his inspection using a portable X-ray machine. An X-ray is just not 100%. You may miss something because there's so many variables. That said by Hal Lowder, L-O-W-D-E-R, an Atlanta-based explosives expert who seems to be the go-to guy in talking about this case. It sounds like he made a bad judgment call, just a bad call. I hate to say bad things, but taking a bomb apart is just not done anymore. The bomb exploded after state police bomb technician William Hakim, H-A-K-I-M, carried it inside the bank and tried to open it with the help of a Woodburn police chief and captain. The latest on this story, from yesterday, the 18th, from the Associated Press, Oregon bomb expert's death leaves many questions. By all accounts, Bill Hakim was one of those solid cops with plenty of experience and solid judgment who other police officers depend on to make a tough decision, especially on the bomb squad. It makes his death in a bomb explosion at a small town bank all the more shocking and puzzling to the law enforcement community. He served as a senior trooper for the Oregon State Police. Hakim, 51, was killed last Friday when he was handling what he believed to be a hoax bomb at the West Coast Bank branch in Woodburn, a farming town of about 23,000 just south of Portland. Also killed was Woodburn Police Captain Tom Tennant, T-E-N-N-A-N-T, who was apparently holding the green metal box that contained the bomb. The city's police chief, Scott Russell, lost a leg and was critically injured, while a bank employee was hit by shrapnel that embedded in the bone of her leg. Police made quick arrests, charging 32-year-old Joshua Turnage and his 57-year-old father, Bruce Turnage, with aggravated murder. No motive has been revealed so far. State police officials have deferred any comment on the case until after a multi-agency investigation is completed, followed by an independent review assisted by federal agencies. They go on to again quote Howell Lauder and basically says, this sort of Bruce Willis, which wire should I cut bullshit, doesn't really happen. So there it is. Two Oregon bomb experts killed when they brought what they thought was a hoax bomb inside the bank. I'll definitely keep watching this. Prove me wrong. This looks like incompetence. The other, if I had to pick, the other big story that those who don't follow the news so much also definitely knew about, and that's, of course, the shoe heard round the world. Shoes thrown at President Bush in protest of his final visit to Iraq. Now, you must see the video if you have not for yourself, where I have to say, if this could be the first positive thing I've ever said about George W. Bush, goddamn, his dodging reflexes are amazing. This guy is really close, and he throws his shoes hard. And Bush, it was maybe the most impressed I've been of Bush, and it just proves that he is an expert at dodging things. Ba-dum-bum. From Raw Story, in Iraq, final visit, Bush ducks a pair of shoes. In his surprise final visit to Iraq last weekend, President Bush got an unusual reminder of his lack of popularity. They were about a size 10. An Iraqi journalist threw his shoes at President Bush during a meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Baghdad. Bush ducked both throws and neither leader was hit. Yelling, "This is the end," and calling Bush a dog in Arabic, the man was later identified as Muntadhar al-Zayadi. Z-A-I-D-I. I've also seen it as Z-E-I-D-I. However, with a story this big, you don't have to search too hard for him. However, the links are there for you to read so much about this story, and we're going to keep going through it. Bush said, of course, that doesn't bother me. I didn't feel the least threatened by it. So what if the guy threw his shoe at me? As he basically tried to smooth it over and says, but that's what happens in free societies where people try to draw attention to themselves. Interestingly, White House spokeswoman Dana Perino suffered a black eye from a microphone that hit her in the ensuing chaos. I've not seen any photos of any gory details of that. The shoe-throwing journalist was wrestled to the ground and taken away, and we'll get to a little bit of that in a moment, too. In Arab culture, throwing shoes is a grave show of disrespect. According to colleagues, al-Zayadi had survived a kidnapping by Shiite militiamen last year. After U.S. troops pulled down a statue of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi bystanders tossed shoes at it. During his visit to Iraq, Bush called the Iraq War hard but necessary for the protection of the United States and the freedom of the Iraqi people, adding that the two nations are on solid footing. The war is not over.
And again, we are just now approaching the video that will show this Al-Baghdadiya television correspondent throwing his shoes at the president. As you can imagine, an unbelievably surprising moment. You see here the president and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And again, one of the television correspondents at this news conference in which the president is there on an unannounced visit, part of a ceremonial signing of the agreement, and you see it there, one right after the other. One of the journalists jumps up, throwing the shoes at the president. Let's listen in. And we have been looking at video that just arrived here a few moments ago. Video of a news conference with President Bush and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki as they talked about their signing of this agreement, the Status of Forces Agreement and Strategic Agreement. Let's listen in to the reaction. Amazing. You see one of the journalists there. We are getting reports that he is from Al-Baghdadiya Television. Correspondent at this press conference reportedly says this is the end. Makes the statement, this is the end, just before throwing the shoes. Patty Culhane joins us now live from the White House. Patty?
Hey, Christina, how are you? As you've just seen the video, President Bush, we should point out, was not injured. As you saw, the shoes sailed over his head. And I'm just going to ask if we could switch the monitor real quick so I can see what you're seeing. We do know that Dana Perino, though, has a bit of a black eye. Apparently, she was caught in the melee to get a hold of this television reporter and got a microphone in her eye. So Dana Perino, the White House spokeswoman, has a bit of a black eye. You're seeing the video here. Apparently, as you said, this is a television reporter, and he screamed out, this is a farewell kiss, you dog. Now, people at home might be wondering, what is the importance of the shoe? Well, in an Arab culture, that is considered, the sole of the shoe is considered an insult. So it was this reporter's way of insulting President Bush during his surprise visit to Baghdad.
At the end of the day, you know, how much real danger was he in? I mean, this was an insulting thing. It was a chaotic moment. It's I don't think anyone would say his life was at risk. So he did move around more on this visit than he was able to in the past. He was able to visit some places and visit with other Iraqi leaders that have been impossible in the past. But in a controlled environment,
Thanks so much, Richard. Incident. We appreciate it. I'm Christina Brown. We return you now to our regular programming.
Now, with the down low on the updates. Iraqi army loves and hates the shoe tosser. This from Danger Room. The flying shoe incident has everyone talking. To recap, of course, Iraqi journalist Muntadir al-Zaidi was detained after flinging his shoes at President George W. Bush during a press conference in Baghdad's Green Zone. Muntadir seems to have struck a chord with Iraqis. Hitting someone with a shoe is a deep insult in this country. The New York Times Baghdad Bureau blog has an excellent roundup of reactions from around the country. The Times even tracked down Muntadir's brother, who said he was proud of his brother, as all Iraqis would be. And then, of course, it gets worse. From roadstoiraq.com, al-Zaidi in Camp Cropper Prison, and at the time wondered if they were being tortured. Iraqi TV reported on the news that al-Zaidi is transferred to Camp Cropper Prison, the airport prison managed by the American forces. The Iraqi TV channel announced that al-Zaidi is in a difficult condition with broken ribs and signs of torture on his thighs. The next day, from thinkprogress.org, shoe-throwing Iraqi journalist beaten in custody. The now-famous shoe-hurling Iraqi journalist has reportedly been beaten in custody, according to ABC News, as well as the BBC. Again, his brother reports that he's suffering from broken hand, broken ribs, internal bleeding. And they, again, thinkprogress.org, reiterate the Iraqi TV report, signs of torture on his thighs. Meanwhile, thousands of Iraqis took to the streets for a second day to demand his release. Post it up for you. Is Bush's boot camp. Of course, wasting no time, somebody busted out a flash game where you try and shoot the shoes before they hit Bush. So that's embedded for you. I find it virtually impossible to play, but it's there in order to flesh out the full context of the ridiculousness. Importantly, a few days later, Bush and the shoe, the full uncut video, thanks to cspanjunkie.org, as Bush makes a crude joke about a size 10 shoe, Muntadir al-Zaidi can be heard screaming in the background. The corporate media, of course, won't show you that entire video. And it's there for you. Update number 5, Bush shoe thrower too injured to appear in court. This again from Raw Story, sourced by Australia's Herald Sun and others. But returning back to the States, protesters celebrate the shoe-throwing journalist in protests outside the White House. A small group of anti-war activists gathered outside the White House Wednesday to show solidarity with the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush last weekend. And those couple of videos are there for you to check out. But finally, on the shoe heard around the world, beyond the flying size 10, a fighting footwear arsenal, of course Danger Room again getting into the act, the shoe hurling incident earlier this week has become a full-fledged phenomenon. So it's about time Danger Room took a closer look at footwear-based weaponry. The thrown boot is a traditional non-lethal weapon. However, technically it might fall into the hazardous classification. Within the non-lethal community, it is generally accepted that any impact exceeding 58 foot-pounds of kinetic energy will result in a potential fatality. That according to an Army article on engineering non-lethal artillery projectiles. That's roughly one half the impact one would feel being hit by a baseball thrown by a professional pitcher. And there are some people out there capable of hurling a boot with considerable force. And again, a hat tip and a cheers to my man Alex in Germany, always adding good research and comments to the post on MediaMonarchy.com. He's got a comment at the bottom of the shoe, heard round the world. However, I gotta get to the coming criminal cabinet and chaos of your personal friend and savior, the Obamasiah. My name's James. Thank you for returning to regular programming. Obamasiah, tests, challenges, CFR cabinet, Monsanto, and more. First, from the Washington Post, DC's metro system can't handle the incoming Obamazoids. That's my headline, not theirs. Even if only half the projected 2 to 4 million people show up for next month's presidential inauguration, the Washington region's roadways and transit systems will be too pressed to handle the crush. Officials are working out details of their transportation plan for the event, but the capacity of the area's transit and road infrastructure, combined with strict security, means residents and potential visitors need to have realistic expectations about how quickly they'll be able to move around. People who live near the Arlington Cemetery metro station, for example, are planning to take the subway to the swearing-in ceremony, might want to think about walking, because trains will be packed. On foot, the 3-mile trek from the station to the reflecting pool at the Capitol will take about an hour. The related note of many, again from the Washington Post, your tax dollars hard at work, inaugural last call moved up. DC bars and nightclubs will be allowed to serve alcohol until 4 a.m., not 5 a.m. during inauguration week, after the DC Council voted to modestly scale back the emergency legislation it approved 2 weeks ago. They approved 5 a.m. Some folks balked, so they backed it up to 4. so it's 2 hours extra anyway. Under the revised rules, nightlife establishments will still be allowed to remain open for food service round the clock from January 27th to the 21st. However, they will have to pay a registration fee for each evening they intend to stay open past the normal hours of 2 a.m. on weekdays and 3 a.m. on weekends. Nightclubs will be required to pay $250 a night, and bars and restaurants will have to pay $100. The council initially extended the bar hours at the suggestion of the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington, whose members want to capitalize on the expected crowds for the Obamasias coming. But the move drew criticism from community leaders, religious organizations, and Senators Dianne Feinstein, Robert Bennett, and others, who wrote a letter of protest to D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty and Vincent Gray, the council chairman. Inaugural last call moved up. Last call for freedom of speech. One more inaugural note. This from the AFP, but with an editorial note from Infowars.com, the U.S. military is mobilizing troops for the inauguration. The editorial note being a sign of things to come. In years past, the Secret Service and local law enforcement were responsible for protecting the president during the inauguration. Now that duty has apparently shifted to the military and NORTHCOM. It would seem NORTHCOM's not enough, however. General Jean Renault says, quote, an integrated air defense system, including Canadians, will be up and robust and available. Since when have Canadians been tasked with protecting the president during his swearing-in? Canada and the U.S. signed an agreement that paved the way for militaries from either nation to send troops across each other's borders during an emergency. I guess we're to consider the inauguration of Obama an emergency. Now, the report from the AFP, the U.S. military plans to mobilize thousands of troops to protect Washington against potential terrorist attack during the inauguration of President-elect Barack Obama, a senior U.S. military commander said Wednesday. They will fly combat air patrols and man air defenses, organize large-scale medical support, and help local law enforcement provide security in the Capitol. Again, General Renault, head of NORTHCOM. It's not because we see a specific threat, because for an event this visible, this important, and this historic, we ought to be prepared to respond if something does happen. He, of course, said some 7,500 active duty troops and 4,000 National Guard troops will take part in operations in support of the inauguration of the 44th U.S. president on January 20th. That's about 12,000 troops. A few updates on the Chicago corruption of Governor Blagojevich, and of course, his connections to Obama and Resco and Operation Board Games. Again, as we went over last week, as this story was breaking, I popped open Webster Tarpley's new book, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, where he wrote this summer that the indictment of Blagojevich may happen, but not before the election, only after the election, as a way for the banksters to say, hey, don't get too big. The RNC smears Obama with Blagojevich scandal. That's from Raw Replay. You can watch that clip. Another one, an FBI informant, and again, I'll have to grant we know how trustworthy that can be. An FBI informant says Blagojevich was a mob-connected bookie. The local ABC affiliate in Chicago has learned that a Chicago attorney told the FBI that Rod Blagojevich was a bookie that made regular payments to the Chicago mob during the 80s. Robert Cooley says that he told the FBI about wrongdoing by Blagojevich years ago. When I was working with the government wearing a wire, I reported I observed Rod, the present governor, who was running a gambling operation out in the western suburbs. He was paying street tax to the mob out there. You can watch that video, and there's more. You can link to ABC7. And a funny one that wraps up any Blag Obama updates. As Brass Check TV notes, and the Young Turks put up a video. Of course, indicted governor finds Jesus. The governor of Illinois recently got caught red-handed trying to sell Obama's recently vacated Senate seat, and the whole indicted politician finds Jesus thing began back during Watergate. The crook who perfected this scam, Charles Colson, C-O-L-S-O-N, has made a profession of bringing Jesus to the powerful who are newly indicted. Now, Rod Blagojevich hasn't exactly found Jesus, per se, but if we hit up ChicagoDefender.com, Baptist ministers offer governor pastoral care. To an overwhelming majority of state leaders, and according to recent polls from the citizens of Illinois, he is the state leader charged with some brazen illegal activity and should immediately resign. But to a few black ministers, embattled Governor Rod Blagojevich is a downtrodden soul in need of pastoral care. So, Reverend Marshall Hatch and three other pastors accepted an invitation by Blagojevich to come to the state's executive Northwest Side home last Friday and pray. They better pray hard. Now, of course, the Obamasiah has been named the Person of the Year by Time Magazine. And we can, of course, note that Hitler was named Person of the Year. And, of course, Time Magazine was founded by Henry Skull and Bones Luce. So take your Person of the Year and smoke it. Going to the Washington Times, Greens worry Obama will drop their cause. Or, as I would put it, they're now having their oh shit moment. Oh shit, that's right. Change ain't fucking coming. Environmentalists fear their top priority, a national climate change policy, will be sidetracked in Congress by concerns over the slumping economy. President-elect Obama said the policy is a matter of urgency and furthered his commitment last Monday by naming the top members of his energy and environment team. He said the team would lead his drive towards renewable energy and away from oil and would coordinate the blah-bitty-blah. Yet the Green Lobby, filled with optimism after the election of a Democratic president and Congress, now sees the expanding meltdown of the economy as a major obstacle. There's really no one to root for in that story. If we move to WorldNet Daily, and of course, always an update on the Obamasiah, and the coming criminal cabinet, and when all the jobs are lost, you can always get a job with Obama's Civilian National Security Force. But there's some new rules for Obama's Civilian National Security Force. New rules published in the Federal Register would allow certain civilians to call American soldiers into action inside the U.S. to prevent environmental damage or respond to special events and other domestic activities. The alarming warning is contained in proposed rules published last week for the Department of Defense Defense Support of Civil Authorities Plan. It's all coming together, isn't it? From ABC News, Cheney praises Obama's national security team. I must say, I think it's a pretty good team. I'm not close to Barack Obama, obviously, nor do I identify with him politically. He's a liberal. I'm a conservative. But I think the idea of keeping Gates' defense is excellent. I think Jim Jones will be very, very effective as the National Security Advisor. Darth Cheney, really happy with Obama's national security team. Of course, as we noted before, Max Root, or Boot, rather, and other neocons, really, they're really kind of digging Obama's cabinet. We've noted how these administrations are working hand-in-hand for this supposed quote-unquote transition of power. We've noted, folks have said, I've never seen anything like it. It's like a co-presidency. This from the New York Times. Bush preps crisis briefings to aid Obama. The White House has prepared more than a dozen contingency plans to help guide Obama if an international crisis erupts in the opening days of his administration, part of an elaborate operation devised to smooth the first transition of power since 9/11. The memorandums envision a variety of volatile possibilities, like a North Korean nuclear explosion, a cyber attack on American computer systems, a terrorist strike on United States facilities overseas, or a fresh outbreak of instability in the Middle East, according to people briefed on them. Each then outlines options for Mr. Obama to consider. The contingency planning goes beyond what other administrations have done, with President Bush and Mr. Obama vowing to work in tandem to ensure a more efficient transition in a time of war and terrorist threat. The commission that investigated the September 11th attack, noting problems during the handover from Clinton to Bush, called for a better process, quote, since a catastrophic attack could occur with little or no notice. This is very unusual, said Roger Cressey, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, a former Clinton White House counterterrorism official who was held over under Mr. Bush. We certainly did not do that. When the transition happened from Clinton to Bush, remember, it was a totally different world. You had some documents given that gave him a flavor of where things were at, but now you got two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and a hot war against Al-Qaeda. This is very unusual. A salacious op-ed posted up at McClatchy, D.C., rails against those mindless challenges over Obama's birthplace. What about those challenges? Let's jump to the Associated Press. Supreme Court won't review Obama's eligibility to serve. The Supreme Court has turned down another challenge to Barack Obama's eligibility to serve as president because of his citizenship. The appeal by Court Rutnowski of Greenwich, Connecticut, was denied last Monday without comment. Rutnowski argued that Obama was a British subject at birth and therefore cannot meet the requirement for becoming president. At least two other appeals over Obama's citizenship remain at the court. Not anymore. Philip J. Berg of Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania, argues that Obama was born in Kenya, not Hawaii, as Obama says, and Hawaii officials have confirmed. Federal courts in Pennsylvania have dismissed Berg's lawsuit. Federal courts in Ohio and Washington State have rejected similar lawsuits. Allegations raised on the internet say the birth certificate showing that Obama was born in Hawaii on August 4th, 1961, is a fake. We can hit links in there, hit up the AP. Justice Kennedy rejects two more challenges to Obama. There's another from WorldNet Daily. And of course, you should always hit up Phil Berg's site, ObamaCrimes.com. The Democrats are determined to reimpose the Fairness Doctrine. This from Kurt Nimmo. It seems the Democrats are determined to reimpose the Fairness Doctrine. Earlier this week, Representative Anna Eshoo, E-S-H-O-O, Democrat of California, a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, said she would work on bringing back the federal regulation. I'll work on bringing it back. I still believe in it, Eshoo told the Daily Post in Palo Alto. Eshoo said she would recommend the doctrine be applied not only to radio and TV broadcasts, but also to cable and satellite services. It should and will affect everyone, she promised. The so-called Fairness Doctrine would restrict free speech on the public airwaves, stifling dissent at a time when an open national dialogue about our country's future is essential. That's said by House Republican leader John Bonner of Ohio. The American people do not believe the federal government should be in the business of dictating or restricting the content of political speech. I'm troubled by Representative Eshoo's comments, and my hope is that President-elect Obama will speak out against efforts by members of his party to use their majority power to limit free speech and dissent. The Fairness Doctrine. Policy of the United States FCC that required the holders of broadcast licenses both to present controversial issues of public importance and to do so in a manner that was, in the Commission's view, honest, equitable, and balanced. The Fairness Doctrine, more Orwellian doublespeak. I wish I had time to go into it, but it's massive. But my man, Jello Biafra, seemingly out of the blue, has penned a massive missive, Jello Biafra's open letter to Obama. It's posted up on firedoglake.com, and I implore you to check it out. It's long and well-written and has many, many good points. I still haven't made it through the whole thing myself. Jello Biafra and his open letter to Obama. The coming criminal cabinet gets more criminal by the day. This from the LA Times, with an appropriate headline change from cryptogon.org. Obama picks Monsanto creature Tom Vilsack for the Secretary of Agriculture position. Former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, who aggressively campaigned for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton before his state's caucuses in January, will be named Agriculture Secretary by President-elect Barack Obama, three Democratic officials confirmed Tuesday. The formal announcement was expected that morning at a news conference in Chicago. So, let's hit up organicconsumers.org for six reasons why Obama appointing Monsanto's buddy, former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, for USD head would be a terrible idea. This from November 12th. Organicconsumers.org, ahead of the curve, saw which way this one was going. Their points sourced and linked for you. Vilsack's support of genetically engineered pharmaceutical crops. The biggest biotech industry group, biotech industry organization, named Vilsack Governor of the Year. When Vilsack created the Iowa Values Fund, his first poster child of economic development was the Transova and their pursuit of cloning dairy cows. Vilsack was the origin of the seed preemption bill in 2005, which many people in Iowa fought because it took away local government's possibility of ever having a regulation on seeds, where GE would be grown, having GE-free buffers, banning pharma corn locally, etc. Vilsack has a growing, or rather glowing, reputation as being a shill for agribusiness biotech giants like Monsanto. Sustainable agriculture advocated across the country were spreading the word of Vilsack's history as he was attempting to appeal to voters in his presidential bid. An activist from the West Coast even made a YouTube animation about Vilsack with a link for you. The airplane in the cartoon is referring to the controversy that Vilsack often travels in Monsanto's jet. Finally, Vilsack is an ardent supporter of corn and soy-based biofuels, which use as much or more fossil fuel energy to produce them as they generate, while driving up world food prices and literally starving the poor. Those are just six reasons why now Tom Vilsack, as head of the USDA, is more bad news from the coming criminal cabinet. Oh, but hey, that's not all. From the New York Times, Obama names more Council on Foreign Relations and Goldman Sachs ghouls to his top economic posts, pledging to create a 21st century regulatory framework to protect against future financial crises. Obama, on Thursday, nominated three veteran financial regulators to top economic positions in his administration. Jumping down. In the conference, news conference, in the morning, Mr. Obama named Mary L. Shapiro to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. The agency has come under sharp criticism for its failure to detect signs that major Wall Street banks were in trouble before the financial crisis, and more recently for gaps in its oversight of the New York financier Bernard Madoff, who the authorities say is confessed to running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. More on that in a little bit. The Madoff scandal, Mr. Obama said, reminds us yet again of how badly reform is needed when it comes to regulations that govern our markets. Mr. Obama also announced the selection of two former Clinton administration economic officials, Gary Gensler and Daniel Tarullo, to both leading economic posts. Gary Gensler, G-E-N-S-L-E-R. Goldman Sachs for 18 years, and of course worked on the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Daniel Tarullo, T-A-R-U-L-L-O, professor of law at Georgetown, on the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve, Council on Foreign Relations. More CFR, more Goldman Sachs, more insiders to Obama's coming criminal cabinet. Now, speaking of the cabinet, the criminals, but who pulls the strings, of course, as we've pointed out time and time again, Zbigniew Brzezinski. His daughter, Mika, one of the talking heads on MSNBC, was apparently mugged outside of the D.C. hotel, and there's a video of them talking about that. However, whenever we mention Brzezinski, and we're talking about Obama, we gotta mention Russia. This from Press TV. Russia to test Obama's mettle. The incoming U.S. administration is to be given an assessment of its decisiveness by Moscow over missile issues. The Russians intend to test the mettle of the new administration and the new president, said U.S. Acting Undersecretary of State John Rood, R-O-O-D. He told the AFP that Wednesday. The official made the remarks commenting on the recent Russian stance on the U.S. planes for installation of a European-based missile defense apparatus. In some ways, their position is less flexible than it was before, and I think that, therefore, leads me to the conclusion that they would like to determine the posture of the new administration. Or they just don't want to be encircled as Brzezinski and the trilateral bankster boys play little countries against each other to encircle Russia and China. It's all coming together. The Obama-Siah. Tests, challenges, CFR cabinet, Monsanto, and more. We now must move and focus on the Econo crash. Panic, Ponzi predictions, scenarios, and nightmares. First from Fortune magazine, they talked to 8 of the market's sharpest thinkers for their scary predictions. So from Fortune magazine, 8 really, really scary predictions. Number 8, and the one we're going to focus on, is from Noriel Roubini, where he says, we're in the middle of a very severe recession that's going to continue through all of 2009, the worst U.S. recession in the past 50 years. It's the bursting of a huge, leveraged-up credit bubble. There's no going back, and there's no bottom to it. And, of course, the link for you to read the other 7 scary predictions. However, we do try and note when people like Joseph Stiglitz or Noriel Roubini talk, we want to listen. A couple other guys we always want to listen to are Peter Schiff and Ron Paul. There is an excellent piece on financialsense.com from Peter Schiff, A Nightmare Before Christmas. It's heady stuff, and again, as I've said, I don't claim to fully understand the whole phony economy. But let's get a breakdown. This is a nice little best of piece that somebody put together. Ron Paul and Peter Schiff on our economic collapse.
Some people that got stranded on an island, and I think it was 6 or 7 were Asians, and there was 1 American. And as soon as they got stranded on the island, they had to divvy up the jobs. And 1 Asian was given the job of fishing. The other one was hunting. One of them got a job of gathering firewood, you know. So they all had jobs, and the American was assigned the job of eating. And so at the end of the day, they would all gather around and prepare this feast, and the American would sit there and eat it. And he wouldn't eat it all. He'd leave just enough crumbs so he can give it to the 6 Asians so they can go on and repeat it again tomorrow, spend all day preparing a meal for the American to eat. And now the way modern economists would look at it, they would say, well, this American is vital to the whole island economy. Without him, nobody would have to fish, nobody would have to hunt, nobody would have to gather firewood. I mean, he's creating all this employment on the island. But the reality is, Every Asian on an island, his lot in life would be dramatically improved if they kicked the American off the island. Because now they'd have a lot more to eat. Or maybe they wouldn't have to spend all day hunting and fishing, and they can lie on the beach a little bit.
Why do you think that a recession is coming? Just how bad is it going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty bad. Whether it starts in 07 or 08, I think, is immaterial. And I also think it's going to last not just for quarters, but for years. And what's going to happen in 2007 is a lot of these artificially low ARM payments are going to be reset upward. You're going to start to see both the government and the lenders reimposing lending standards and tightening up on credit. And you're going to see a lot of the speculative buyers turn into sellers. And these sky-high real estate prices are going to come crashing back down to earth. And what's going to happen now is we're going to see the subprime-type loss scenario unfolding in other asset classes, such as bonds backed by auto loans, credit card debt, and that's really going to, you know, pull the rug out from under the consumer. If you've got these cronies in Washington, they're like little kids with a chemistry set, and they keep on throwing these chemicals together, trying one thing after another. They hope they're going to stumble on a miracle, but they're going to blow us all up.
Where are the real conservatives? There was one, you know, Ron Paul, but they drummed him out of the Republican Party. He's talked about all this. He's warned about all this, but everybody has ignored him and others like him. I mean, I get marginalized in the mainstream financial world, just like Ron Paul's been marginalized in the political world.
Ron Paul really has no business being on stage as a legitimate representative of Republicans.
So Congressman Paul, and I'd like you to take 30 seconds to answer this, you're basically saying we should take our marching orders from Al-Qaeda?
Are you suggesting the United States of America caused the attack on 9/11?
That Ron Paul is no one who wanted to make a name for himself.
Another question about electability. Do you have any, sir? There is always the question as to whether or not...
When we make a mistake, it is the obligation of the people through their representatives to correct the mistake, not to continue the mistake.
And that's what we do on the floor of the...
No, we've dug a hole for ourselves and we've dug a hole for our party. We're losing elections and we're going down next year if we don't change it. We're going down next year if we don't change it.
Peter Schiff and Ron Paul, a little best of for you. So there they are back in 2006, 2007, 2008, saying the crash is coming. They're causing it. And their supposed fixes will only make it worse because fundamentally we don't have a sound monetary policy. Another note, Ron Paul was on the Alex Jones Show on December 17th. That interview is linked up for you. But before we move on through this econo crash, panic, Ponzi prediction scenarios and nightmares, we're now into hour number two of episode 104 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. It's December 19th, 2008, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority and RevereRadioNetwork.com. Right now, for the first time, Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech, streaming MediaMonarchy.com live for you. And here we go. Four really, really bad scenarios. This from Politico.com. However, again, Cryptagon points out the most interesting one of the four really, really bad scenarios. That would be the alternate dollar nightmare. The number one vulnerability is the dollar itself. We're printing them and shoving them out the door, and the Fed is basically out of bullets. So why hasn't the dollar collapsed? The short answer is global investors don't have any other choice. That is, there simply aren't enough euro or yen-backed securities for investors to shift their money out of dollars and into some other currency. But what if some kind of a global coalition, say a trillion-dollar sovereign wealth fund allied with several countries around the world, banded together to create a gold-backed alternative to the dollar? From Time Magazine, dovetailing nicely with that, alternative currencies grow in popularity. Most of us take for granted that those rectangular green slips of paper that we keep in our wallets are inviolable. The physical embodiment of value. We could do a whole show going into that sentence right there. But of course, as always, I give a link for you. The one that explains it all, the Money Masters. But back to the article, alternative currencies grow in popularity. But alternative forms of money have a long history and appear to be growing in popularity. It's not merely barter or primitive means of exchange like seashells or beads. Beneath the financial radar, in hip U.S. towns or South African townships, in shops, markets, and even banks, people throughout the world are exchanging goods and services via thousands of currency types that look nothing like official tender. Alternative means of trade often surface during tough economic times. When money gets dried up and there are still needs to be met in society, people come up with creative ways to meet those needs, says Peter North. Not the porn star, but the senior lecturer in geography at the University of Liverpool and the author of two books on the subject. He refers to the scrips issued in the U.S. and Europe during the Great Depression that kept money flowing and the massive barter exchanges involving millions of people that emerged amid runaway inflation in Argentina in 2000. People were kept from starving this way, Peter North says. Alternative forms of currency. There's a video of bankster elite extraordinaire Mayor de Rothschild, Lord Rothschild on CNBC. That video is there for you. I'm not going to play it right now. We're going to jump to Reuters. Downturn spurs survival panic for some in the U.S. A paralegal recently laid off wanted to get back at the establishment that he felt was to blame for his lost job. So when he craved an expensive new tie, he went out and stole one. The story, relayed by psychiatrist Timothy Fong at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute and Hospital, is an example of the rash behaviors exhibited by more Americans as a recession undermines a lifestyle built on spending. In the coming months, mental health experts expect a rise in theft, depression, drug use, anxiety, and even violence as consumers confront a harsh new reality and must live within diminished means. People start seeing their economic situation change, and it stimulates a sort of survival panic, said Gaetano Vaccaro, deputy clinical director of Moonview Sanctuary. And you can check them out at moonviewsanctuary.com. They treat patients for emotional and behavioral disorders. We are in a survival panic. We are prone to really extreme behaviors. IMF chief warns of riots in response to economic crisis. This from Paul Joseph Watson. The head of the International Monetary Fund has warned that advanced nations will be hit by violent civil unrest if the elite continue to restructure the economy around their own interests while looting the taxpayer. During a speech in Madrid, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, K-A-H-N, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said that, quote, social unrest may happen in many countries, including advanced economies, end quote, if governments fail to adequately respond to the financial crisis. He added that violent protests could break out in countries worldwide if the financial system was not restructured to benefit everyone rather than a small elite. That report goes back to The Guardian with a link for you. Kurt Nemo has Arizona police training for economic civil unrest. As Mike Sunnox, writing for the Phoenix Business Journal, reports that Arizona state and local police, quote, say they have broad plans to deal with social unrest, including trouble resulting from economic distress. The security and police agencies declined to give specifics, but said they would employ existing and generalized emergency responses to civil unrest that arise for any reason. And that's a theme we're going to see thread throughout the rest of the stories, as I said at the top. These are all basically all a part of the same story. We can bust them up into news about 9/11 or Obama and Bush and their co-administration or civil unrest or the Econo crash or the Police State International or in the North American Union. It's all the same story. We're just trying to put the pieces together. What we referenced earlier, and of course, as things spiral out of control, the most fucked up, amazing things are now just like, oh, well, yeah, there's a guy busted for a $50 billion Ponzi scheme on Wall Street. Ex-NASDAQ chairman Bernard Madoff, M-A-D-O-F-F, and his $50 billion Ponzi scheme. Let's get CNBC's David Faber to break it down, and we'll learn a little more of what a Ponzi scheme is.
Well, the questions just keep mounting in the Madoff securities fraud. Many people today trying to figure out just what happened here. And unfortunately, a lot of charitable organizations, a lot of individuals, a lot of formerly what they thought were wealthy people, finding out today that they've got no money left. Really hard for many people to imagine as they sort of try to go through the impact here, while we still really have very few answers to exactly what went on beyond what apparently Bernie Madoff told some of his employees, that being in that complaint. There's a look at Mr. Madoff, 70 years old, arrested yesterday, released on $10 million bail. One has to wonder if these charges are true, how this man was able to sleep at night. Let's talk about quickly, you know, who suffers here? Well, fund of funds. Fairfield Greenwich Group, for example, was seeding Bernie Madoff. Something called Fairfield Century was a key feeder hedge fund into Madoff securities. They were charged 1 in 20. Having access to Madoff was considered gold. And if you had that access, you could just basically see them off the top, go out and find investors and put the money in European banks, the Jewish community, a lot of charities, Tremont advisors. They don't have much to say to us, but we did contact them. They say they're trying to figure it out just like everybody else right now. But they confirmed they had it. And then, of course, market confidence. As I said, he wasn't really a hedge fund, but it doesn't really matter. What are people going to think about right now? Oh, my. Everybody's going to question everything. There is a look at Tremont confirming his as it has exposure in touch with the SEC. Yeah, everybody's going to be in touch with everybody here. One key question, for example, fraudulent conveyance. Let's say you actually got some money out over the last year. Or another question.
Ponzi scheme is a fraudulent investment operation that involves paying abnormally high returns to investors out of the money paid in by subsequent investors, rather than from the profit from any real business. It is named after Charles Ponzi. P-O-N-Z-I. The term Ponzi scheme is used primarily in the United States, while other English-speaking countries do not distinguish in colloquial speech between this scheme and other forms of a pyramid scheme. Charles Ponzi, of course, an Italian immigrant who set up a massive pyramid scheme. And of course, Wikipedia has it all, and you can read about the econocrash and fake economies and hedge funds and zeros and ones. So that wraps up that subheading of the econocrash. And as we see sprinkled throughout there, as places within the North American community are gearing up for civil unrest, due perhaps to the econocrash, or perhaps some other event yet to unfold. But they're preparing for what is already happening in countries abroad. So we just briefly mentioned, of course, the collapse of Argentina. But in only recent weeks, we've seen the near collapse of Iceland. And now we have civil unrest in Greece continuing. It's only a small minority of people that resort to such measures like breaking and looting.
It had been intended as a peaceful day of protest to coincide with a nationwide strike. So much for that idea. Within minutes, the rally by Greek workers was hijacked by anarchists. And so began a fifth day of rioting. The police again chose to contain, but not to confront. Whether handing over the streets to the anarchists is weakness or wisdom is a point of major debate. Even on the fringes of the violence, passions are high. Arguments are breaking out on street corners. You only have to watch and listen to realize this is not just a security problem, but a full-scale political crisis for the Greek state. And tonight, around Athens University, the heartland of student radicals, rioting has flared up again.
Anarchy in Athens, of course, is nothing new. But what has taken people is the destructive fury. It's being driven, as we find out by talking to people, by a hatred of the state, and of police in particular.
I participated to this just because I don't like police, because the behavior of the police against me in the past, and actually for no reason, was awful.
We are here for the cops, nothing else.
But there are other grievances too. There's anger at political corruption and at economic prospects. In both Athens and Patras, there is still no sign the protests will end anytime soon. But in a remarkable sign of an emerging backlash, in some places, shopkeepers and other middle-class Greeks have entered the power vacuum. Here, hurling stones back at the anarchists.
Shattered glass and scattered rocks litter the city, sight across Greece's capital, bear the evidence of a week of riots. The landmark University of Athens saw the latest in a series of standoffs between protesters and police. In a sixth straight day of anti-government violence, some 4,000 people took to its grounds last night. The ongoing clashes follow the shooting of a 15-year-old boy by a police officer 7 days ago. Evidence of trouble from the night before. Workers are now accustomed to cleaning up the damage. Protesters wielding firebombs of rocks and police firing tear gas. Riots have been further fueled by deep popular anger over corruption and economic hardship, which resulted in the worst unrest Greece has seen since the aftermath of its military rule in the 1960s and 70s. Though the demonstrations were less intense last night, they're not expected to be the last.
This is an ugly battle, and neither side looks ready to back down. Athenians might have hoped for a sleepy Sunday. Instead, they got this.
It's now almost 24 hours since this violence began in the city centre. At the moment, it seems that the riot police are succeeding in holding a group of anarchists and extremists back from the central police station. As you can see, the air is absolutely thick with tear gas.
Some people came to demonstrate peacefully, to show how upset they are that the police had killed a teenage boy.
We do not support the looting and vandalism, but we do support the protest, the peaceful protest. There's only a small minority of people that resort to such measures like breaking and looting. This is not the majority of people, just want justice.
The violence had raged through the previous night. It began here, in the notorious neighborhood of Exarchia. This not the first time these streets have seen pitched battles between police and anarchists. But it's rare for the fighting to spread across the city centre with so much destruction.
Protests must and should take place. Citizens have every right to defend their ideas and principles. But let me stress, not by destroying people property.
For Athenian shop owners, this could not have come at a worse time. In the run-up to Christmas, and with the economy already hurting. A dark cloud over Athens, but also over the prospects of its conservative government. Clinging on to power with a tiny majority. Many Greeks wondering if now is the time for a change. Barnaby Phillips, Al Jazeera, Athens.
Greek protesters aren't giving in. It's the fifth day of violence since a teenage boy was shot dead by police. This time protesters marched on Parliament as two unions staged a general strike against the country's economic policies.
I feel rage about what we're seeing now, and who knows what will come. They don't understand what's going on. They're not getting through to the youth. They're just speaking like politicians.
Young people are really angry. This is all of society. All parents are angry, just like the parents of the killed teenager. We are enraged at the policies of the government.
Earlier in the day, there were street battles in Patras. Riot police were called in after protesters marched on a police station, throwing petrol bombs along the way. Some local residents then tried to attack the rioters. They were angry about the damage they were causing. Tension clearly remains high across Greece, where there have been running street battles in various cities in recent days. Scores of shops, businesses and homes have been set alight, as have the offices of the foreign ministry. Many Greeks are frustrated by the government's apparent inability to quell the violence.
We have to understand what people need, why young people are upset, not just look a bunch of hooligans smashing things up.
I have only one thing to say. I'm ashamed to be Greek.
The strike rally went ahead despite a plea from the government. The Prime Minister's position, precarious before the trouble began, is now critical. The violence has added a massive bill to an already struggling economy, and traders have virtually given up on any Christmas cheer.
Civil unrest in Greece continues. And as much as that was just a quick taste of the many videos about the civil unrest in Greece that's been going on. And you can check all those videos out there linked up for you. However, some of the articles. First, Greek protesters unleash the lasers. From Danger Room, police around the world use everything from sonic blasters to pepper spray to skunk bombs to plain old dung to control crowds. But sometimes the protesters can turn the tables with tools of their own. Take the clash in Greece, where, with the photo that's posted up, a protester uses a laser pointer to show where a riot cop is. And as a commenter notes with an update, a laser like that can do more than just show where an officer is. It can stun that cop with an extremely bright flash of light. The photo is amazing. Further proving that this is all one story, Trends forecaster Gerald Salente says that Greece-style riots are coming here. frighteningly accurate trends forecaster Gerald Celente, who we've covered now time and again on MediaMonarchy.com, says that America will see riots similar to those currently ongoing in Greece, and that the cause will be a hyperinflationary depression leading to the inevitable use of troops and mercenaries to deal with the crisis as Americans are incarcerated in internment camps. As we have highlighted many times before, Gerald Celente's accuracy is stunning. He predicted the 1987 crash, the subprime mortgage crisis, and the panic of 2008, and is routinely cited even by mainstream news networks as highly credible. The cause of riots would be a hyperinflationary depression, Celente told interviewer LouRockwell.com, causing Americans to revolt in similar circumstances that we have witnessed recently in Iceland and Greece. The trouble would be sparked off by Obama declaring a bank holiday whereby people won't be able to withdraw their money. What's going on in Greece with these riots have nothing to do with a 15-year-old boy being killed. That was only the spark that ignited the pent-up, really, hatred and disdain people have for the scandals and corrupt government, and the same thing is going on in this country as well. Celente reiterated his prediction of a revolution and riots in America and said that the first signs of it could even emerge before the end of the year. Celente said the troops now being brought back to America for, quote, domestic security, would be used to suppress the riots.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to see a revolution, and we expect it to happen, and probably this year we'll start seeing some of it.
So what do you think the upshot of that will be? Will they just suppress it? Is that why they're bringing the troops home?
Well, they're going to try to, obviously, and there are all these this talk about opening up these detention centers and hiring the goon squads, the Blackwaters, and the rest of them to run them. So these are realities that are going on as we speak. And whether they keep saying that they're opening up these detention centers in the event of migrant problems, but of course it's much bigger than that. I mean, you know, it's under the Department of Homeland Security, and KBR, the engineering and construction subsidy of Halliburton, has been awarded a $500 million one-year base period for to get these national emergency, national disaster centers up and running. So yeah, you know, it's in the cards. They know what's going on, and we're really in a period of off with their heads, and it's going to be the people against the politicians, the new kings and queens of commerce as well.
You know, we have far too big a country, too big a government, but far too big a country to have one government attempting to rule this vast region. Do you think there's any chance of a breakup of the U.S. in this sort of revolutionary situation?
Yeah, absolutely there is. The secessionist movement's real, and we think they're going to continue.
So there is some hope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you know, America, you know, is a very flexible and resilient country. You know, we're not being flexible or resilient because Big Brother is taking over. The government now operates and owns the largest insurance companies, the largest mortgage company. They're going to be owning a piece of the auto industry. So, yeah, you know, it's a fight against the totalitarian government. You could call it communist, when a state-owned monopoly runs everything, or you could call it fascist, or you could call it socialist. But the one thing you cannot call it is free market enterprise. So yeah, there's going to be rebellions, and you know, things will make change for the better if we break up with this criminal governments that are in place now. And I don't say that lightly. You know, the war in Iraq is being fought for false reasons. Whether or not they knew it was false is an academic question. The reality is it's false. So under the moral code that I was raised in my religion as a Catholic, you know, killing people, innocent people, for fake reasons is a crime, as is robbing people blind, as they're doing now with these bailouts and other types of criminal activities that are just stealing. So until that system changes, nothing will change.
Well, certainly while Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, I'm sure, but he didn't kill a million people like George Bush has done, a million innocent civilians just in his war in Iraq.
Again, it had nothing to do. Remember, there was no weapons of mass destruction ties to Al-Qaeda, the two reasons we were given to go to war. So you can't change the reasons, obviously, although they try to, as to why we're at war.
Gerald Celente talking to Lou Rockwell on the Lou Rockwell podcast, talking about $2,000 gold and the breakup of the U.S. I also have the flashback link for you where we covered Gerald Celente back in January of 2008. Futurist foresees rough times. grabbing some quick updates on the ongoing civil unrest in Greece. First, from the Associated Press, Greek protesters take over TV and radio stations. Greek protesters pushed their way into television and radio stations Tuesday, forcing broadcasters to put out anti-government messages in a change of tactics after days of violent street protests. Another one from VOA, Voice of America, Greek protesters call for demonstrations across Europe. Greek protesters have hung two giant banners from the Acropolis in Athens with multilingual slogans calling for demonstrations across Europe. Inside accounts of activism in Greece from dollarsandcents.org, where they note what's taking place in Greece is much larger than, of course, the police killing. In its immediate context, the uprising of the last 10 days comes on the heels of a rising oppositional movement. Finally, from the New York Times, protesters riot again in Athens. Violence flared again in central Athens on Thursday, yesterday, December 18th, when rioters threw rocks and firebombs at the police and tried to burn down the city's main Christmas tree, which had just been replaced. The old tree was burned down in a demonstration last week during the worst spasm of protests in Greece in recent years. Christmas shoppers fled the area as protesters smashed storefronts and overturned and damaged cars. As we heard in the previous clip, pretty much losing all hope for a happy Christmas. As long as we're international, let's jump to the next heading, Police State International, Tracked, Traced, Tortured, Erased. First from Jeffrey Kurz, by way of blacklistednews.com, Masonic Big Brother is watching, but seniors don't mind. And that's senior citizens. Censors keep track of just about everything Shirley Player does in her apartment, but she's not worried that Big Brother's watching. Far from it. I feel very safe with it. It's nice to know you're being watched. Player is one of the 68 residents of the Masonic Care retirement community participating in a study that aims to determine whether keeping a technological eye on seniors can help them live longer independently in their own homes. You got to go to MasonicCare.org so you can see, of course, their little logo with the house and Masonic Care and their, of course, compass and square. It's also important to remember that the Masons are also working on that RFID implantable package for your kid. That's all linked up for you as well. But we're going to jump to Google seeking to cut net censorship deal. It's not played in the press that way. Looking to get an edge. But what's the bad side of that? Google is lobbying internet providers and phone companies to establish a separate internet traffic lane in order to prioritize the search engine's giant content, according to the Wall Street Journal. Google has for years been one of the loudest advocates of internet neutrality, the practice of giving all internet data traffic the same level of priority. However, the Wall Street Journal, with a link for you, reveals that the company, which now incorporates YouTube, wants to set up its own fast track on the web. The precedent this would set would be to allow companies to pay internet providers for preferential treatment. Smaller companies, businesses, and websites could be left operating in the internet slow lane, unable to compete with the elite of the corporate world. Links in there for you to CNET and, of course, the Wall Street Journal. Just another sign of the coming Internet 2. But if we go to school, and there's a video I posted up for you. It's on youtube.com/MediaMonarchy. Children forced into cell-like school seclusion rooms.
I can't understand why the school system, he didn't like to wear a belt. Now, he was a little fella. I guess he had some pants on that was a little bit big on him. He would, when he was at church and stuff, he'd take and play football. He'd hold his pants up with one hand and run. But I don't understand why school system give him a real long rope to hold his pants up. And then when they send him to that timeout room, they take her, called seclusion room, I guess. They give him a rope to hold his pants up, and they, before he goes in there, they go and take his shoes and stuff, but they let him have the rope. And apparently, well, and then he took him, hung his stuff in that room. They left it in there, and the teacher was supposed to be sitting right there. The teacher was right there. The day of the accident, when we was at the hospital, a school official come up to us and he said, "I'm here to answer any questions for y'all." We asked him, you know, why did they leave him in there with the rope? And all we kept hearing was, "Oh, I don't have that answer. I wasn't there." And every answer we asked him, the comment was, "I don't know. I wasn't there." You know, I felt like he wasn't there to answer no questions, because he didn't have no answers for the accident, for what happened to my son today. Let go, lose his life. I don't know. They took my pride and joy from me. That was my sidekick. Maybe me and him was real close. It hurts every day when you come in the driveway and he's not around no more.
A few weeks before 13-year-old Jonathan King killed himself, he told his parents that his teachers had put him in time out. And they thought that meant sit in a corner and be quiet for a few minutes. But they found out that time out in the boys' North Georgia special education school was spent in something akin to a prison cell. That's out of Georgia. That's from CNN. Children forced into cell-like school seclusion rooms. But as we jump to theregister.co.uk, Microsoft wants to get under your skin. Microsoft's Health Vault, the medical records database, is said to be integrated with Verimed's human-embedded RFID tags, allowing doctors to access the medical records of unconscious patients with a quick scan of the arm. Verimed consists of an RFID tag that is embedded in the arm of a hopefully willing participant and responds with a 16-digital identity code when queried at 134 kHz. This code can then be used to identify the person through Verichip's website and will soon be able to link to their medical records as stored on Microsoft's Health Vault system. Verimed adds an exciting RFID-based option for Health Vault users trying to keep themselves and their families safe, says Sean Nolan, chief architect for Health Vault, quoted in RFID Journal. "If you're excited about the idea of being electronically indexed, then this is the technology for you." Now, from there on this Police State International posting, it just gets worse. Cheney admits detainee abuse role. This is one of those duh, but of course it's important to point out and put it on the record. Vice President Darth Cheney said for the first time Monday that he helped get the, quote, process cleared for the brutal interrogation program of suspected terrorists. In an interview with ABC News, Cheney was matter-of-fact and unapologetic about the harsh techniques used against detainees, including waterboarding, a form of simulated drowning considered torture since the days of, the Inquisition.
Vice President Cheney sat down with ABC's Jonathan Carl for an exclusive interview. The vice president talked about his role in controversial interrogation tactics used on terrorist suspects and made a startling admission about the questioning of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
Did you authorize the attacks that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in fact, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do. And I supported it. There was a period of time there, 3 or 4 years ago, when about half of everything we knew about Al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves.
In hindsight, Do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
What do you say to those that say you've changed?
Well, the way I think of it, in terms of whether or not I changed, I think a prime motivation for me in much of what I've done was 9/11. And have I changed? Well, not in the sense that I've gone through some, you know, fundamental psychological transition here, but I have been, since that day, focused very much upon what we need to do to defend the nation. And I think the policies we've recommended, the programs that we've undertaken, have been good programs. I think those have been sound decisions. And if that's what they mean by saying I changed, I'm guilty.
You heard it. He said it himself. I'm guilty. He supported it. The mask fully slips. But it's nice that he is such an unapologetic bastard. There's not a whole lot of hiding with someone like Cheney. Jumping to another one from the Associated Press, feds say anti-war CDs included in suspicious packages sent to the National Guard, with an editorial note, this stinks to high heaven of something like a COINTELPRO operation designed to make anti-war activists look like terrorists. So, from the AP, suspicious packages have been sent to National Guard and Reserve facilities in 36 states. Federal authorities said Wednesday, initial reports from the Guard that one of the packages contained a powdery substance turned out to be incorrect. The 51 packages included anti-war compact discs and began arriving at locations around the country last Friday, said National Guard spokesman Mark Allen. Now, I'm sure watch that space to see that they sent something crazy. 9/11. Conspiracies. There's a report about white powder sent to U.S. embassies abroad, but I wrapped it up for you with just the update. Of course, tests negative on white powder sent to U.S. embassies. That's just the headline for you. Another one, Navy killer drone complete. Danger Room, of course, has the update and the beautiful photo of military technology porn. Its first flight is set for 2009, and of course, more dead Pakistanis will be the ultimate result. Hit a link to the BBC. Again, lost count. U.S. drone kills two in Pakistan. This was just from Tuesday, December 16th. A suspected pilotless American drone fired a missile into a border area of Pakistan, killing two people. More from Danger Room. Details emerge on failed nuke inspection. It ain't easy for an Air Force unit to pass a nuclear inspection these days. Air Force Times has details on the flunked test that Danger Room first reported last Saturday. It sounds like paperwork issues blew the exam for the 90th Missile Wing. Inspectors failed the 90th Missile Wing after discovering the maintenance group had not properly documented tests done to its missiles, even leaving some tests completely undocumented. An unsatisfactory grade on any portion of the NSI nuclear surety inspection fails the entire wing. And if paperwork screw-ups are the worst they do, then... Whew. The Dutch Minister of Foreign Affairs says that, quote, we need an international order. Reiterating the calls, whether they're talking about a new financial world order or just global governance. Gordon Brown, New World Order. They all say it. The mask has slipped. Revelation of the method. It all kind of comes out in your face now. This from the AFP. War on terror, a generational conflict, Bush says. Again, it's nice sometimes when they just say what's up. The United States war on terror, war of terror, will continue for many years to come, Bush said Wednesday in a speech on his national security legacy. Bush, who leaves office on January 20th, compared the fight against terror to the Cold War of the post-World War II years. Like the struggle against communism during the Cold War, the struggle against terror will be a generational conflict, one that will continue long beyond my presidency. One of the numerous updates and links to Daily Dose of Terror, economic riots and U.S. collapse as Brzezinski's puppet prepares for attack. But we're going to jump to McClatchy. Iraqi spokesman says that U.S. troops might be needed for another decade. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki last month sold the Iraqi people on a security pact with the U.S. He called it a withdrawal agreement. Of course, jump back to October, MediaMonarchy.com. He called it a withdrawal agreement to end the presence of American forces in his country by the beginning of 2012. However, his top government spokesman undercut that claim when he said in Washington that the U.S. might be needed in Iraq for another 10 years. The statement reverberated with political leaders in Baghdad and renewed criticism of the deal. There's a scathing one from globalresearch.ca, the failed logic of supporting the troops. More from Daily Dose of Terror on Mumbai terror, truth unfolding. However, the last couple bits, looking at Russia, from the AFP, Russian police arrest 150 at opposition protests. Russian authorities arrested Sunday at least 150 people taking part in opposition demonstrations in Moscow and St. Petersburg, organized, of course, by former world chess champion Garry Kasparov. Police spokesman said about 90 people were detained in Moscow and 60 in St. Petersburg for attempting to take part in unauthorized demonstrations. So whether it's Greece or Russia or prepping for it in the States, the riot police are out and locked and loaded. So whether it's supposedly a police killing in Greece or God knows what's going to happen here, they're prepped for it. One last one from Daily Dose of Terror. Russia, Cuba, China terror drills, ABL, and the plague war threat. But we're going to come back home. There's one, I think after I listened to it and posted it, I think we covered this before. So the video's up there for you, but I'm not going to play the clip. But I can't quite remember if I played it, so I'm going to stop talking about it. Anyway, it was Lou Dobbs on CNN covering, of course, the combat brigades in the States. Lou Dobbs on martial law and posse comitatus. However, let's move more to the present and see how this is being implemented. Of course, earlier on, we touched on the tens of thousands of troops that are going to be available for the inauguration. But let's jump to San Bernardino, California. Marines established presence in San Bernardino. So the article from Kurt Nimmo by way of Branson Hunter on the Big Bear Observation Post blog, bbvm.wordpress.com. The links are all there for you. Marines established presence in San Bernardino. The Marine Corps Air and Ground Combat Center and the local California Highway Patrol are going to be working together over the holiday in a joint effort to reduce accidents and drinking and driving in San Bernardino County. The USMC, United States Marine Corps, will be present on public roads in order to set up a military presence during routine DUI check stops. They will be working closely over the month to cut down traffic accidents. The military police will observe DUI checkpoints and watch for their own guys. The intent is to have a military presence out there.
The local California Highway Patrol station held a highly questionable DUI license checkpoint Friday night. When they announced the checkpoint, they said they'd be doing it along with military police. Z1077 ran an editorial reminding the CHP about federal laws prohibiting the military from enforcing civilian laws. At about 11:30 Friday morning, we received a fax from the local CHP office announcing the action would not include military police. Also, by law, to avoid entrapment, the CHP is required to provide the location of a checkpoint to the media at least 2 hours prior. They did provide Z1077 with a phone number to call at 7 p.m. to get the location, but, defense lawyers take note, no one ever answered the phone. To add insult to injury, when the CHP held the checkpoint in front of the Home Depot in Yucca Valley, they did indeed include marked military police cars as well as uniformed military police.
So that's the confirmation coming from KCDZ-FM in Joshua Tree, California, noting that the California Highway Patrol, of course, was less than forthcoming with their plan to team up with the military police. Of course, all this is a direct violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, preventing the military from performing civilian law enforcement duties. Out the window. A disturbing white paper think tank piece from the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Institute. The report is, with a nod to Rumsfeld, I guess, known unknowns. Unconventional strategic shocks in defense strategy development. So this from Steve and Paul Watson. Army Strategic Shock Report says troops may be needed to quell U.S. civil unrest. Does that sound familiar? A recent report produced by the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Institute warns that the U.S. may experience massive civil unrest in the wake of a series of crises, which it has termed strategic shock. Kind of like the shock doctrine. The report, titled, as I said, Known Unknowns, Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development, also suggests that the military may have to be used to quell domestic disorder. Quote, widespread civil violence inside the United States would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities and extremists to defend basic domestic order and human security. Download the PDF, read it for yourself. Strategic Shocks, coming soon. A last little bit about tasers on this Police State USA posting. Dobbs, Marines, and tasers from Raw Story. Sold as non-lethal. If we're keeping score, tasers have killed 400 people since 2001. They're marketed as non-lethal weapons that allow police to capture suspects or criminals without causing any permanent harm. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and businessman Bernard Carrick made millions selling the idea to police departments around the country. But tasers have killed more than 400 people since 2001, according to a new study commissioned by the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Police departments across Canada began banning the use of tasers by their officers after the report found that tasers deliver more power than the manufacturer says is possible. It is unknown if U.S. police departments will follow suit. I would have to say that it is pretty known, and they won't. Parents and law enforcement spar over tasers in schools. This from WBNS. Two mothers have pulled their children out of the Southwestern City School District after one of their sons was shocked with a taser, but authorities defended the use of such weapons, saying they cut down on injuries to officers and citizens.
Taser is used to break up a fight between students at school. It is not unheard of. In fact, KTV's Andy Hirsch reports more and more school districts have officers walking their halls carrying the same weapons they use out on the streets.
Cameras at Franklin Heights High captured this cafeteria brawl. Two teenage boys fighting over a girl. Watch what happens next. The school's resource officer, a Franklin County Sheriff's deputy, comes in to break it up with his taser. Margie Preston, one of the boys' mothers, was stunned to learn school resource officers, or SROs, even carry tasers.
I was just shocked. I thought, oh my God, you know, if you can't paddle him at school, but you can do something like this, that's extreme. I think that's ridiculous.
But tasers and other stun guns are popping up in more and more schools as a tool SROs use to keep the peace. And many districts tell us they don't regulate how they're used. An officer walking the streets is no different than an officer walking the halls.
Just because it's a school, especially a high school, it's really the same for us as it was, you know, as if those two same kids were fighting on the street.
Franklin County Sheriff's Lieutenant Dave Oyer tells us tasers are much more accurate and effective than using, say, pepper spray, and don't pose the threat of long-term injury batons can cause. In fact, several law enforcement agencies we talked with call taser-like devices lifesavers, claiming they've dramatically cut down on injuries to officers and citizens.
I don't like the idea. I mean, I think it's wrong.
Still, Shannon Sargent, the mother of the other student in this fight, isn't convinced her son wasn't hit by the taser. She's not sure what would have happened if he was.
Well, my son has a heart murmur, and I don't know if that can cause any kind of damage to it. You know, it's small, but, you know, it's still a heart defect.
The National Institute of Justice has found there is no conclusive medical evidence that indicates a high risk of serious injury from devices such as tasers. When people do get hurt, it's usually similar to what happened to Cody here. You can see, after getting hit with a taser, he falls to the floor. He cut his head, prompting a trip to the hospital. But that has parents asking, fighting, why not just pull the fighting kids apart?
If you go to try to pull someone off, one of the parties that's involved in a fight, well, the fight doesn't stop right there. The other fighter just continues on, and you become part of the fight.
And if an officer thinks a taser is the best way to handle a situation like this, even if it's kids fighting in a school, don't be surprised to see them pull the trigger. Andy Hirsch, 10 TV News.
Now, an investigation found the use of the taser in that fight at Southwestern was justified, but we want to know what you think. So take part in our 10TV.com poll.
And, of course, it's bitterly humorous to note that the mom says that when she found out about this, she was shocked. Ba-dum-bum. Lastly, on this Police State USA, Dobbs Marines tasers from the AFP, Amnesty International warns against potentially lethal tasers. Amnesty International warned Tuesday against a proliferation of taser stun guns, saying they were responsible for dozens of deaths in the United States and should only be used in extreme cases. In a report entitled Less Than Lethal, The Use of Stun Weapons in U.S. Law Enforcement, the London-based human rights group urged governments to either limit their deployment to life-threatening situations or to suspend their use. Industry claims that so-called conducted energy devices are safe and non-lethal, do not stand up to scrutiny, it said. Links are there for you, and you can, of course, download that full PDF from Amnesty International, Less Than Lethal. I don't think I'm going to have time to get into the last few postings, but I'll wet your whistle with U.S. anti-kidnap expert kidnapped. New York Times NSA whistleblower reveals himself, and Richard Falk, UN human rights investigator, expelled by Israel. Of course, with the flashback that we note, Richard Falk, UN human rights official, would like a new 9/11 investigation. That's going to do it, my friends, for this 104th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And now, for the first time ever, coming to you live from the Revere Radio Network, revereradionetwork.com, streaming to you live. Getting bigger. So, again, as we note the loss of our friends at Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta, they were FCC'd. We can cross our fingers and hope that they can bob and weave and return again to the world of low power FM. You know what time it is. It's time to look at the bizarre list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. This past week, no exception. It's always interesting. If you're new to this, I use StatCounter.com to keep track of the hits I get on MediaMonarchy.com. And when you install that code, it gives you the back end to monitor where your traffic's coming from, what people clicked on to land on your page. 99% of the time, it's Google searches, of course, again, showing the power of Google and what would happen if they were to go against net neutrality, as we noted earlier. So initially, when I started to see creepy government installations and businesses and private military contractors show up on my website, it kind of wigged me out. But instead of being nervous about it, I keep a log of the most interesting searches and hits that I get and log them up and post them up for you. They're there for you, and you can check them out, and I read them for you right here. So, first, on the list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week, the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. Someone there Googled 9/11 Truth KSM. Philip Morris USA out of Richmond, Virginia. They were reading about Arthur C. Clarke, futurist and sci-fi genius, when he died at age 90 many months ago. Someone in a dorm room, dorm.brandeis.edu at Brandeis University in Massachusetts, Googled Sing Along with JFK. Of course, we went over those funny songs using samples, literally, of JFK back in the 60s and making a record and putting different music to it. Those are, of course, all posted up thanks to WFMU.org. One of the first of many military visits out of Orlando, Florida, headquarters USAISC. billboard blasts passersby with audio advertisement. Of course, as we noted most recently on the Project Bluebeam story, TV fakery, holographic projections, and audio projectors. Of course, this story, billboard blasts passersby with audio advertisements, was about that billboard in Times Square a few months ago that sent a beam into your head and you heard the advertisement in your head. It was for a paranormal show on A&E, showing that the technology is there. And, of course, the military has thought about it, as they've also thought about projecting deities up into the sky in what I suspect could be a new world of worlds psyop. But I digress. North Dakota State University out of Grand Forks Googled weather mod research. And again, another Army headquarters, this time out of Fort Riley, Kansas. We also had the Texas Christian University out of Fort Worth, Texas. We had Brown University out of Providence, Rhode Island. They Googled Ewan Cameron memory, of course, leading to my post, Ewan Cameron, the memory thief, of course, the wicked doctor, one of the many behind CIA's MKUltra mind control programs. Declassified, not conspiracy theory. NORAD, out of Colorado Springs, Googled NORAD shield art. And, of course, Danger Room always does many catalogs of the bizarre military patches for the different agencies and drills and exercises. So NORAD was Googling to look at their own shield art, but, of course, they got more than they bargained for on MediaMonarchy.com. New York's Office of the Attorney General was reading about judge strikes down part of Patriot Act. That's going back a ways on MediaMonarchy.com. The NEA, National Education Association, out of Leesburg, Virginia, hit me up from BlacklistedNews.com. USA Today was reading about the Cyberstorm terror drill from a few months back. The Commission of the European Communities out of the UK, was reading about the U.S. anti-kidnap expert that was kidnapped. We're going to get to go over that next episode. The New York Times Googled National Level Exercise, January 2009. It's good to see that the old gray lady is doing some homework. Of course, as we noted a month ago here on MediaMonarchy.com, Northrop Grumman and FEMA will be running, quote, National Level Exercise 09 very soon. Someone in Costa Mesa, California, Googled, did Charles Manson ever live in Martinsburg, West Virginia? No, he didn't. However, they landed on my story about how a documentary recently shot a bunch of footage in Martinsburg, West Virginia, because it looked just like rundown hippie San Francisco in the late 60s. And, of course, there are Manson and West Virginia connections, but we're not going to get into that right now. NBC Universal Googled Waco, OKC, Columbine. Again, Texas Christian University out of Fort Worth, Texas, Googled Project Bluebeam, Holograph, Crown, Cork, and Seal. A sort of shipping and packaging place out of Philly, they Googled David Miscavige, Philadelphia. David Miscavige, of course, the head of L. Ron Hubbard's Scientology cult. Science and Technology Facilities Council, AC.UK out of Oxford, they Googled holographic TV. Western Union Googled Mary Shapiro, CFR. And, of course, Mary Shapiro, Obama's latest appointee from the ranks of the Council on Foreign Relations and Goldman Sachs. Finally, strangely, frighteningly enough, DARPA.mil, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, out of Silver Spring, Maryland, Googled 9/11 updates, or rather, lawsuits, liability, chat logs, and flutes. They didn't Google it. That's a typo on my part. They were on my page from what StatCounter said was no referring link, which leads me to believe that perhaps DARPA bookmarked MediaMonarchy.com. So if DARPA can bookmark it, you can too. And that's going to do it for episode 104 of MediaMonarchy.com. Thanks for listening, my friends. I love you. We're going to get through this somehow on this winter of our discontent, of course, bringing glorious summer at some point. And we'll get there. And I'll see you next week on the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.